All right. Well, I think everybody is back, so let's go ahead and get started with the introductory slide. So, welcome everyone to the 11th annual GraduCon. Obviously, we are doing this all remotely, and we are incredibly appreciative of all of the panelists for continuing to be able to do this event. So, thank you so very much. My name is Brianna Connick. I'm Associate Director of Graduate Career Development in the Office of UChicago Grad, which is the organizing office for this large event. And today, for this panel session, we're going to be focusing on your first years as faculty in STEM. And this conversation will go till about 3:50 Central Time. So we've had a very busy day, as you can see from the schedule of different panel sessions. We're in the very final one, so hopefully everyone in the attendee group is in the correct one. Again, first years as faculty in STEM. We do want to just kind of go through a few of the features for the audience to use that we're going to ask you to kind of do different things here, and that for the Q&A feature, we would like you to submit any questions that you have for the panel to that feature, and you also have the option to upvote the ones that you like the most during that or in that feature. Now, if you are having any technical issues, please use the chat to let our staff know, which will be me and another colleague kind of monitoring things on the back end. Now, just remember, we are not IT professionals, so we will do our best to help you navigate any technical issues. But that's how we're going to be using the different Zoom features for today. And then I'm not going to go through all of the introductions, of course, because they'll introduce themselves, but I just really want to welcome our fantastic panel that we have today from a really great mixture of different types of institutions that they're currently at, but also from a wide variety of different types of backgrounds and their times at the University of Chicago. So we have a few people that did their postdocs at UChicago and a few people that did their PhDs there. And also our moderator, John Anderson, who's a current assistant professor in the chemistry department. So we'll go ahead and stop sharing these slides really quick. Thank you. Before we dive into the panel discussion, I just wanted to launch this quick poll. So if I could ask everybody in the audience to participate in the poll that I just launched. This is really to ask two main questions of who's here. So the first one would be, are you a master's student, PhD student, postdoc, alumni, or other? And then the second question being, what division are you a part of? So if I could ask the attendees to vote in that poll. Let that go for a little bit to allow people to vote. Not actually getting anybody voting.
It's technical difficulty.
Technical difficulties. Let me see. Did not see the poll. Cannot use the poll. Okay, hold on one second. Let me relaunch it.
I see a poll now.
Oh, there it goes. Okay. So some technical difficulties. Here we go. Now people are able to vote. Fantastic. Okay, so we'll give everybody like 30 seconds to chime in on this poll. Oh, it looks like we have quite a number. Thank you. Guess they were ready to go since I was priming. Okay, a couple more seconds. But this is mostly just to share kind of who is actually in the audience listening in on the topic today. So I'll go ahead and end the poll now and then share the results. So as you can see, we have the kind of largest population as PhD students, followed by postdocs, not surprising. And then in the divisions, we have several people, biggest group from the biological sciences, and then physical sciences, followed by molecular engineering afterwards, and a few scattered in some other sections. So thank you so much for chiming in on that, and we're very happy to have you here today. So I'm going to officially close this out and then let John start off the panel. And I'll be in the background if we have any technical issues, but thanks.
Okay, well, let's dive in. I think the first thing, or the general format that we're going to try to follow, is going through some kind of typical questions that generally come up in most of these panel type discussions. And this is going to involve going around all the panelists and hearing some of the generic things, and I'll kind of lead those questions. And then the hope is that in the second half, we can open this up more to questions from the audience. So as Brianna was saying, if you have a question, feel free to post that at any point in time in the question panel. You can do it now if something really, you're itching to ask something. But if something pops up as we're going through things, then feel free to put that there, and then we'll kind of go through those in the second half as people want. Okay, so the first thing that we're going to kind of do is have each of the panelists introduce themselves and describe their career pathway from grad school to where they are now. So I'll start with that. So I was actually an undergraduate at UChicago, and then I went to graduate school at MIT. I moved halfway through my PhD to Caltech with my advisor, and then I did a postdoc at Northwestern before starting here at UChicago in 2015. So I'm an inorganic chemist. So we make transition metal complexes and look at catalysis and things like that. Okay, who wants to go next? I think Stas, you're at least counterclockwise for whatever that's worth on my screen. So I'll call on you.
Well, on my screen, I'm somewhere like in the upper row. But, well, thank you. So my name is Stas Bedring. So I'm an assistant professor at the Northern Illinois University. So I have a joint appointment between the Department of Physics and the Department of Electrical Engineering. So I graduated from St. Petersburg State University in Russia. So then I moved to US. I worked for about a year and a half for a commercial company called Euclid Tech Labs. As a scientist or postdoc, I don't know like how to call this. So it was just a job. Then after that, I moved to the postdoc position at the University of Chicago, where I stayed for about 2 years, a bit more than 2 years. And then I got this position at NIU. So I'm with NIU for about a half a year. So my research interest is obviously physics. So to be specific, it's accelerator physics and everything which is related to the development of future accelerators, particle accelerators. That's briefly it. So, thank you.
Hey. All right, since I realize not everyone has the same orientation that my screen does, maybe we'll go alphabetical. That's still alive by last name, because you're BA. I'm A, so I started even better. All right, so the next one then would be Beatrice.
Hi. My name is Beatriz. I did my undergrad in Spain in chemical engineering, and I worked for a couple of years there in Spain, and then I moved to the States. I did my master's in polymer science, and then I went back to industry for 4 years more, and then I decided that I really like to come back to academia. I did my PhD at Northwestern University in the chemical and biological engineering department, and my postdoc I did it at UChicago with Jack Gilbert. We recently moved to UCSD, and I moved virtually with him, although I always remain in Chicago. And I just joined in October the Department of Bioengineering at UIC. So my interests are very, very diverse, but mostly right now I am looking at, I have been working in reproductive biology, in systems biology for reproductive biology through infertility, for infertility, and now I'm looking at depression during pregnancy and postpartum and the role that the gut microbiome plays on that.
Okay, Madeline, we'll go M next.
All right, I'm Madeline Marshall, and I did my undergraduate at McAllister College in St. Paul, so a liberal arts college, and I went from there straight to my PhD in the geophysical sciences department at UChicago. And spent 6 years there, and I graduated with my PhD in the summer of 2018, and I went straight into a visiting assistant professor position at Cornell College in Iowa, and so I spent a year there as a VAP, and then I am now an assistant professor of geology at Albion College in Michigan, which is a small liberal arts college. And my focus generally is on sedimentary rocks, stratigraphy, and paleontology. So I work on how do fossils get preserved, and particularly I'm interested in how nutrient-rich environments impact the preservation of biological material. So I kind of, I was in the physical sciences division, but we were part of the Darwinian cluster, and so kind of merged a little bit with the bio side too.
Cool, yeah. Okay, Avery?
Hi, Avery Posey. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania. I was a PhD student at the University of Chicago, PhD in genetics with a track in developmental genetics. I moved from there to a postdoc at UPenn in a field that deals with genetic engineering of immune cells for the treatment of cancer. It's a mix of cancer biology, immunology, molecular engineering, and gene therapy. And I stayed here as an instructor for 3 years after my postdoc and just transitioned to an assistant professor tenure track.
Okay, cool. All right, well, the next sort of general question that we'll go through, and I think people should feel free to chime in. I won't call on everyone in particular. Maybe just for now start talking with an eye towards letting everybody speak if they have something to say. But the first sort of thing that we want to talk about is the job application process and some of the kind of harsh realities of that, dealing with numbers and statistics and things like that. So things like how many applications did you do? How many interviews did you end up getting? How many campus visits did you have? And what was that process like? What did you do to prepare? If you got an offer, did you negotiate? How much did you negotiate? And then finally, now that you've been on the other side of that process, hopefully in some manner, are there any tips that you give to people who are about to go through it? So does anyone want to start? Any particular experience that anybody wants to share?
I can start. So while I was finishing my PhD, I applied to, I think, around 6 jobs that year. And I had looked around for postdocs too, but there just weren't really many in my field of interest. And so there were a lot of faculty positions. And so I focused on the ones that I was really interested in that year. And I got, I think, 3 phone interviews out of that, and then got invited for 2 in-person interviews. But the first one that I did, I really liked it, and it was kind of in the right location for me. And so I kind of went for that. And then last year, while I was a visiting professor, I applied to 20 jobs, and I kind of applied across the board, anything that was of interest to me, and I got 11 phone interviews out of that, or Skype or whatever. And out of those, I had 6 on-campus interviews, and ended up getting 2 offers. And so that was like super helpful for being able to negotiate, to have kind of 2 offers in hand. And the chair at Albion, who so I was communicating with the chair of the geology department about negotiating with the provost, and she found it really helpful that I had another offer to kind of hold up and show the provost as I was asking for my startup and kind of figuring that out. I did negotiate, and I talked with several of my committee members at UChicago about the negotiation process, and I also talked with Brianna in the grad office, and essentially what I learned was that, like, there's not much wiggle room on the salary side of things. They budged a little bit, but it's really an equity issue, and so the salary didn't move too much, but to kind of compensate for that, they did give me the entire startup that I asked for. And, you know, it's good to know that the startup at like a liberal arts college is going to be far less than at a more research-oriented institution, but there still is startup. And so kind of in comparing the two job offers I was weighing, the salaries between the liberal arts college and it was an R2, salaries were fairly comparable, but the startup at the R2 was about double of what I got. And I felt like the colleagues that I would be dealing with and the lighter teaching load really kind of made up for any of those number differences. I think one of the most important things as I was interviewing was figuring out exactly what the teaching load is, because everyone kind of throws around like the number of credits, and you know, that means that translates to a different number of like a different amount of work for the faculty member at every institution. So I think that was really important to figure out what my time commitment would be. And you know, time, as everyone figures out, is the most valuable resource. And so figuring out how to get the most of that in negotiation.
Yeah. And one thing that I'd like to echo on that I didn't appreciate when I was a graduate student or a postdoc is that when you're negotiating, you think that the chair or whoever you're directly seeing in the negotiation is someone that's an adversary. And in almost all cases, that's not true, right? They want you to get the most startup that you can get that helps the department. And even with salary, in many cases, if you get a higher salary than someone that's been there for 5 years, then that gives that person an impetus to go to the dean and ask for a higher salary themselves. So it can feel greedy to do some of that, but in many cases, it's not a zero-sum game, and it can be beneficial for the whole department and your colleagues if you negotiate for better startup, better equipment, or even better salary. So I think that's an important thing to know going into negotiations. It's hard to not feel maybe greedy in that case, but it can be beneficial for everybody. So, okay, does anyone else want to chime in on their kind of search process?
I can go?
Yeah.
So for me, it was, my path was as far as I went to the company, right? So the first search that I did, so when I was looking for my postdoc position, when I was with the company, so I should admit that I have not applied much. So I just sent about like 3 applications. And one of those 3 applications, basically, I've got reply from the University of Chicago. And just because it was University of Chicago and everything looked really nice, the group and I just liked the place when I came. So I just accepted this without even considering anything else. That's funny, maybe. As for the assistant professor position, so in my field, in accelerator physics, it's kind of like, it's kind of hard to find a professor position. So it's much easier to get into national lab, so that's the regular path, but the professor positions, they're kind of limited, and there are quite few universities who like eager to hire like somebody who has expertise in accelerator physics. So from that perspective, I was looking like basically everywhere, but I have prioritized universities. So I sent out about small number, 8 applications. So but I got 6 replies. And all 6 replies led me to the phone interview, and then where it was possible, a site interview. But the only one place that was the university among all those applications was not an Illinois university. So because I was in the first place targeting career in academia, so that was my obvious choice. I would agree with John on negotiation. So that's a really interesting point. So you're negotiating, actually, the people who cares about the money, they are not the people whom you interact with. So you talk, say, with the department chair, right? Department chair really wants you because, okay, so they already accepted you, right? So if you pass the site interview and they say like, okay, so they give you the offer. So this means that the department wants you in the first place. Now you basically try to tell them what you need to be successful, and the department wants you to be successful in the first place. So then department basically is trying to negotiate with the dean and with the college. So that's the way it works. And then the dean says, no, I will not give you that much money. But like if you ask, if you would justify why you need the money, why you want the raise, like why you want a higher salary, why you need, want a bigger startup, and actually writing down like what you need for your startup is a very great idea. So drafting some type of a budget, you know, what kind of equipment you possibly want, right? So what you want to have, not buy, but just have, right? So how many students do you want? Do you want a postdoc? Why do you want a postdoc? Those are very good questions to think about, because sometimes people will not offer you the money as the money, but they will offer you some other things. Like they will say, like, we have a program where we can basically hire students for you and they will work for you, but it's not the money equivalent. But if you ask for the students, but not for the money, that's the way it's going to work. Same for the equipment, for example. So if you need some specific equipment, you're not really aware of what kind of equipment possibly could be there at the university, right? Or at the place where you're applying. So you say, like, I need like this and this machine. And you say, like, I want to buy it. And that's why I want like $1 million on my startup. But then the department would reply and say, like, you know what? We actually have this. So let us, like, say, arrange some access for you to this machine. Would that work? And you would be like, yeah, okay. See, so you have to think not about the money, but about what you want. I was given a very good advice when I asked, like, how I should negotiate my startup, or like, how I should do the negotiation. And the person whom I asked just said, like, ask what you need. That's it. Just ask what you need. So think what you need to do your research, and that's it. If you just need a laptop, okay, just ask for the laptop, and that's that simple. But if you need something else, just make a list and explain it. It would be really easy for you to explain why you need all those things and connect it to what research you are doing.
Yeah.
As for the site interviews and other things, it's a kind of long story. So the only, I don't know, like maybe that's too naive. Just don't lie. Don't try to lie about the things that you like not capable of. That's maybe a very stupid advice, but sometimes I saw some people like exaggerating way too much what they can do. And when you exaggerate way too much, you can face troubles once you'll be accepted, right? Because then you'll have to deliver, and that might be tricky. Other than that, I don't know, just try to present your research from a nice, good perspective, to show how this research could be framed within what is already at the department. So how you're gonna, how this will fit in into the department, for example, that's a good idea as well. Something like that, I would say.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I guess one thing that we haven't touched on that much yet was this perspective of being on the other side of the interviews now, to some extent. So, I mean, Avery, Beatriz, or Stas and Madeline, do you have any thoughts on the process, seeing it from the other side at this point?
No, I haven't had the chance yet.
Okay.
So no, but I mean, I know what they were looking for when they asked me to join. In my case, it was a very peculiar situation because I have been a visiting postdoctoral scholar at UIC, so I knew the university, I knew how to get things down, I knew everybody, so I have a lot of support, so it was easier for me. But they were looking somebody that complements what they were having there. One thing that also I learned is like a lot of schools are looking for people that can demonstrate that can get grants, and that's what they were looking. At least in my department, they were looking for somebody that they could go and start running and start bringing money. So anything that can demonstrate it, that you have that capability, it will be super helpful. Then the other thing that they were looking, I mean, in their case, they were very interested in my profile. But in general, you look for somebody that you can get along with, that you think that you can collaborate with, that they are willing to teach what you don't want to teach. I think that I'm trying to think what else. And from the chair perspective, that you are productive. Like I agree with all of you, like with my chair, there was a kind of misunderstanding of what the type of position I was looking for. and the startup. So when I send them my startup with all the reasoning for each of the things, like I eventually made it up, like not as much as I would have liked it, but at least 90% of what I asked for. And then also I was able to negotiate the teaching load. So for instance, the first year, I don't have to teach at all. And that has been very helpful for me because now I have time to write grants and train people. What was the other thing that I'm trying to remember? Oh, the number of graduate students that some universities, they can give you like, oh, I give you one graduate student for free. You don't have to come up with your startup or two undergrads or whatever, or two grad students. So at UIC, they have that policy that they will give you one grad student for free all the years. And then if you get an MD, PhD, also is paid. Their tuition and their salary is paid for you. So that's really helpful. So kind of things like that, you can negotiate it. And then definitely they really want you to be successful. If they cannot give you more, it's not because they don't want to, it's because they cannot. But definitely the chair is going to fight. If they are really interested for you, they're going to fight for you.
Yes. Okay. Anything to add on that question, or should we move on to the next one?
I do. Sorry. So my path to a faculty position, I think, was a lot longer than most people's. I did a postdoc for 5 years, and at the end of my postdoc, I published the first author paper in Immunity. And at that time, I went actually interviewing for positions, and I interviewed in industry and in academia. I think I went to 3 separate places in industry, and I had 1 interview in academia, and I got an offer, but it was a terrible offer. The startup package that they were offering me was something that, in communication with senior investigators, was not going to allow me to have 3 good productive years before needing to get additional funding. And so then I stayed at the institution that I'm at as an instructor, and I did that for 3 years. And during that time, I was able to collaborate on additional research and build a research program for my lab. I had the opportunity to train postdocs. I have a postdoc who has now matriculated to an assistant professor position after I transitioned to an assistant professor. So now I have a check for my trainee list. I have worked with graduate students and now start to have graduate students in my lab, and I had technicians. So I actually went out and applied for an assistant professor position back in at the end of 2018, and I brought a program. I had 17 additional publications since the first time that I interviewed before. And I think that it showed institutions that the breadth of what my potential was. And also I had people that I was going to bring with me. So I had shown the ability to run a laboratory, to manage people, and to drive projects forward. And so I think that set me up differently as a candidate than my previous interviews. And so I think I applied to 9 institutions. I had 7 first interviews, 5 second interviews, and 3 third interviews, and decided to stay where I am just because I think that the research is the best place for my research. And now I'm the youngest member of my department, and we are interviewing for the next member of that department, who would be the more junior than me, and we're seeing candidates that have that range of first one person that we interviewed was 3 years out of their 3 years into their postdoc, had a cell paper, and looked like a good candidate on paper, but then compared to other candidates that we've seen who come with research programs, who have R01 applications waiting at the NIH to be reviewed, that candidate didn't stack up. And so I think that I'm happy about the path that I took to build my program a little bit more than rush into a faculty position, because I think it's time. The time that I spent building the program will help count towards my tenure package, but it started before the clock actually started.
Yeah, no, that makes really good sense. So,
okay. Can I quick jump in for one more thing? So even though this was my first year in this faculty position, we actually went through a search to hire a hydrogeologist this year. And so I got to be on a search committee right away. And it really like drove home to me a few important points that I think haven't been emphasized quite enough, which are like when you are applying for jobs, like do your homework. Make sure that you know everything about the institution and the department that you're applying for, and that you have like a genuinely good reason why you want to be there. I think that was, those are the things that really stood out to me the most. Like both when I was interviewing, you know, it felt the most comfortable when I had done the most background research. And this year interviewing candidates, those who, you know, had really strong reasons why they wanted to be at this college, and they knew things about not only the college, but who their colleagues would be, and also what the student population would be like, and were able to speak very specifically to that, and not just about themselves, because, you know, like, all of you are coming out of an amazing program of UChicago, whether that's, you know, PhD or postdoc. And so like, you've got that. And so like everyone knows the UChicago name. And so it's, you have to make yourself, you know, someone who knows something about another institution too, and can, you know, place yourself there and help them envision you as their colleague.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I think really it's difficult, but a really useful thing is to recognize, all right, make the chair's problem or the hiring committee's problem your problem, which is to say, what things are they worried about for department? What is that department trying to do? Are they trying to be a top five department in a specific area? Are they trying to raise their standing? Are they trying to teach a huge undergraduate population or a small under, you know, and see how you fit into that bigger picture and make the case to that department why you're going to be a good colleague. I think that's a really useful exercise to think through for whatever position you're applying for, and it'll be different for each position. So, okay, so the next sort of question is maybe after you land the job and then the next year to 18 months, kind of the transition into the job position, how did you dive in? How did you balance research and teaching and writing and so on and so forth? And if I am going to maybe jump ahead a little bit, and one of the specific questions that a few people have asked in the question and answer that I think segues into this pretty well is, how much, if at all, did you focus on previous work from your postdoc or your grad school days, getting that published, and balancing getting old projects that wouldn't necessarily be part of your tenure package wrapped up and published versus focusing exclusively on your new stuff that you're working on? So yeah, so tell us about maybe that kind of first year to 18 months. Anybody?
I'm not there yet. I had like 6 months, but it has been like a kind of interesting 6 months. So I don't have to teach, so that part has been easy. I will say like I am spending a lot of time mentoring, because like I'm getting people. Like right now you need to get buddies when you start. You need to get people that they help you out, keep on the research and train them, whatever you are doing. So I am spending a lot of time mentoring people. I don't think that a lot of the younger people, we can get postdocs in our lab right away. So you need to rely on, I started later also in the year, so I had to rely on undergrads and master's students and so on. So yeah, I spend a lot of time mentoring. I am spending a lot of time writing grants. As of right now. And I think that you need to finish whatever you have. You never want to burn those relationships. So, because you don't never know what is going to go down the line. So you want to make sure that whatever you have, you finish it and you get it done with. In my case, it's like a continuation of my research, so it's okay. But I mean, I have a few things that it may not be interesting for me, but you never know. So finish what you have. And in my case, at least for the university, every paper that you have published counts as soon as you start it. So if I have a prior research and I publish in November or December since I started, it counted toward my tenure. So I would finish it, and that's a low-hanging fruit in that case. Finish those. And then the teaching, I cannot talk much about it at this point, but I'm not looking forward to getting teaching, mentoring, and grant writing, and yeah, that would be like far.
Yep.
Totally agree with that. I think clear out the backlog. If you have things that are left over from your PhD or your postdoc, get that published. If it's continuing research, use that as preliminary data on your grant that you're writing. And then consider writing a review on the topic. I think there will be a number of years before you'll have productive research from your own laboratory. And so that helps to buffer that time. Because you do spend a lot of time training new people on how to do things in your lab the way that you want it to be done. And so in my eyes, I think that research from my own lab will come probably in year three. Hopefully we'll be publishing new things from our lab. We'll probably submit some things later this year, which will be year two. And hopefully in year three, we'll have some publications. We've continued to publish things that I worked on as an instructor. So we had something published last month, and that's gonna be the preliminary data for my first R01. So I think that keeping that going is important.
Yeah, I am also still working on kind of cranking out some publications from my PhD, and my PhD was entirely my own project, and so I developed it myself, and I could take everything with me. As I was doing the field research for my PhD, I was thinking ahead, and my advisor recommended that I do this. And so I was collecting samples and data that I knew would make great student projects in the coming years. And so I'm starting to get students working on that. In my first year in a visiting position last year, I did not get research done. I had a 3-3 teaching load, all new preps. It was pretty overwhelming. So I just didn't get any publications done. I kind of knew that would happen. And so this year I'm able to actually spend time on research. I got a partial course release this year. So I taught two courses in the fall and one this spring. I was also able to get permission from the provost to spend all of my startup in the first fall. And so I could get my entire lab, like all the equipment purchased and everything set up. So I am able to actually like work in my lab now. And I think that's kind of an important consideration, because sometimes startup, you're restricted on how much you're able to spend each year. So if you like anticipate what you're going to need immediately to kind of be productive in that way. So I'm still working on some of my kind of graduate work, which is still of great interest to me, and I'm actually expanding on it, collaborating with kind of people that I had met at conferences during my PhD. And so this year has been really wonderful for kind of building new collaborations with other recent graduates from various institutions. And so I'm working on that. And then I have two other research projects that are kind of long going that had been simmering in the background during my PhD. And so I also do collaborative research on geology in Madagascar with the Denver Museum. So I have been able to kind of get back into that. And then I also work in the Grand Canyon, and I started collaborating with some faculty at Augustana College on those projects. And so I think one of those really great things to do in your first year or so at a new institution is to figure out like who do you need to work with to be as productive as possible and to be able to, you know, try new things. Just because you've finished grad school or finished a postdoc doesn't mean that you like have to just stick with what you've always done. So I think it's been fun to kind of start opening some new doors. And so that's kind of like the research side of things. And the teaching side was a huge adjustment. So at UChicago, I was funded through a teaching assistant position. And so I taught a lot of labs while I was there. It was fun. UChicago has like wonderful undergrad students, had a really great time with that. And I felt like I am like very well prepared to work with these undergrad students. And then I got to non-UChicago schools and realized that the population was very different. And so my first year was a huge shock at how underprepared a lot of undergraduate students are. And then this year as well, you know, if you're dealing with undergraduate students who are coming from a public high school system and they might not be great public high schools. Michigan, for example, doesn't have a very high kind of standards in their high school education. And so it's not the student's fault. And I think that's been really important to realize. You know, if you're dealing with students who are entering college, they are bright. Most of them are motivated, but they might not have had all of the advantages that I was used to seeing UChicago students have. And so a part of the mission in our department is figuring out how to work with these undergrads to kind of get them up to speed and understand that like they might not have had any math classes in high school, and that shouldn't limit them from thinking that they could be a scientist. And so I think that's been really important to figure out how to do that. It was really frustrating my first semester, but I've been kind of getting used to that and figuring out like how do I find solutions to this, because when you're outside of like the lab that you got trained in, you have to create your own collaborators. And so my undergraduate students, they are my collaborators. And so I want to be able to kind of train them to work on interesting problems with me. And they're fully capable of doing that. I just have to, like, it's on me to figure out how to get them up to speed.
Yeah, one thing that I'll chip in on quickly is I think that, and this is maybe a slight difference, maybe field by field. So I think maybe in biology, for instance, with Avery and I know some others, you're expected to build up kind of a footprint in an area and then kind of continue in that area to some extent. That's not always true, but as a generalism. In chemistry, there's very much an impetus to make a stamp in a new area or to change kind of tack from what you've done prior to that. So I think the focus on wrapping up previous work is definitely still true. If you have papers sitting out there, get them done. But the advice that I got when I started was to, I didn't know how much time I should be spending in the lab. And the advice that I got was you should be spending as much time in the lab as possible until you have so many papers to write that you can't be productive in the lab anymore. And there's a lot of things you have to do in your first year. You have to develop your classes like we were talking about. But everyone's good at multitasking, I think. If you get an academic position, you have to be good at multitasking. So I think you become good at getting the lab, getting your lab running, training your students, all of these things, right? And then in time, you know, downtime between that, you get good at writing, wrapping up papers, getting classes ready, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah. Okay, any other comments on this sort of topic?
I would just add briefly that I would agree with Avery, so that basically, not with him, but they probably like I kind of really sympathize his way of like, you know, like first building up like a solid program, right? And then going to academia with this program. So it's not like you shouldn't consider this as like, okay, so you've done your postdoc and it's past, it's just behind you, right? So you're starting like from just basically from scratch, from ground. So in physics, at least, oh, the way I see it, so you have to have something. Nonetheless, you may work in some projects that you're maybe involved while you're like doing your postdoc, right? But you still have to develop something of your own. And then having this, you're like your academic position is a continuation of this program that you're kind of developing. So of some ideas that you're developing, of the connections that you gained over work, like over the times you're working as a postdoc, for example, right? Or like when you were like a PhD student, and like, so it's like to be like, I think to be successful and to, you know, to transition like smoothly into this academic position, in the first place, you have to have something in mind. You can't just like step in and say like, hey, that's me. You have to have some ideas of your own. You have to have certain plan. And this plan comes with a preliminary research on certain topics, right? So you probably have something in mind. So if you have a publications and those like transition like smoothly into your academic position, yeah, do this and like continue doing this. But do not limit all your research to only what you were doing as a postdoc. Try to broaden your horizons and like to go further, like to make the next step. And especially if you have your own lab, then certainly you have a project for this lab. And you cannot like build a lab from scratch, from the ground. So you have to have something in mind. And having something in mind means that you're kind of preparing like a year, like 2 years in advance, prior to actually like going for the job market, on the job market for the position. Yeah.
All right, so go ahead.
No, I was gonna say like talking about following up what you had done in your postdoc or not. I mean, in my case, I was funded through the Arno, through the Beckman Foundation. So the project was mine for my postdoc. So that was clear since the beginning, but also Jack Gilbert was like very like, he's like very generous for everything, right? So he never had a problem of me taking that research with me and be my own. So I know that that can be very different if you come to a lab with a professor that is paying for your postdoc. Then it's his own research, his own idea, and then he may not be willing to for you to take it with you. So you always, I feel like whenever you start a postdoc, you need to talk with your PI about that and how generous or not they are going to be on taking your projects. Because sometimes they started a new line of research out of the blue, maybe in physics is easier, but if you are doing biology or systems biology, that's harder. In my case, I'm doing human research, so that's really hard to start for the novel. The whole thing. So I think that depends also on the field, and you need to be mindful about that.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, this was great. So I think what we'll do is we're about halfway, maybe a little over halfway done. So what I'd like to do is switch to questions submitted by the attendees. And actually, as a starting point, I know there have been some upvotes and things, but I'd like to actually just go with ones that have kind of been specifically addressed to people, and then maybe we'll do some broader ones first. So Avery, you are popular, unsurprisingly. There's been a couple of questions directed straight towards you. So maybe what would be good would be for you, if you just want to answer the, if you can access them, maybe you can just repeat the question and then answer it to the panel broadly, and then that may also stimulate other people.
Sure. So one question to me was, did my time as an instructor count towards my early investigator status for funding? And I think this is in relation to NIH grants, probably also NSF grants. There is a credit, I think, that younger investigators get on their grants can allow for you to receive funding that received a score that may be close to the fundable range. And I think that's for 10 years post your PhD, your terminal degree, do you qualify for this status? And so yes, that time counts. So the time that I spent as an instructor is 3 additional years post my terminal degree. And so now for early investigator status, I have until 10 years post, so until spring of next year. And so I've been trying to capitalize on that status by submitting grants now. And so I think I have until March of next year to submit my last R1 or grant application where I would get early investigator status.
And this is maybe the other side of having the chance to build up a research program beforehand, is you're burning some of that clock for some of these early investigative things, but, you know, maybe as a plus and minus to some of that.
Absolutely. There was another, I don't see anymore. Oh, what made me choose academia instead of industry? Personally, I like the academic freedom of working in academia. I felt that the interviews that I had in industry were for projects that I thought were interesting but restricted. In academia, as a PI in my own lab, I can choose whichever research direction my lab will go in. And for that, I'll start by using some non-restricted startup funds, which I think keep as long as you have, because they're non-restricted, they don't end. And so if you can get early grant money, early nonprofit or foundation money to support you, your lab, and burn through that money while you keep your startup, you may need that later. There is no additional startup for promotion to associate professor. And I've talked to people in that position who would really like to have some non-discretionary funds that you can start new research with. And so I think that for me, that money is important. And that's what I would start new projects with. But I have that freedom in academia. I also think that I have interest in entrepreneurism. And that's one reason that industry looks great, that you can make a new drug and you can see it go through people. But we do this in academia also. My lab has a drug that we've made that's now in phase one clinical trials. We've spun out two companies out of my lab and have aspirations to take that further. We're applying to NIH for some small business funding to do that. And so I think that the things that looked attractive to me as a postdoc in industry, I see those now in academia. And I see actually the potential to profit off of your ideas better in academia than in industry.
And Avery, I thought there was one more question that was about how you got your position where you were able to build up a group of people.
Yeah, so I think that, so I started as after my postdoc as an instructor, and I believe that those positions are common. They are extensions on postdocs. It's not necessarily true at all institutions. At my institution, there was a limit of 5 years for a postdoc. And then you have to choose a path if you're going to stay in that same lab or at that same institution. You have to choose a path. Either you're going to apply for a faculty position or you're going to apply for the next stage of that trainee spot. And so there's an instructor or I think research associate, and research associate is considered more non-tenure track. And then for us, instructor is considered more towards the tenure track, that you're probably gonna apply for a tenure track position. I believe that those positions are common, but I do think it is helpful to use your network to get those. Definitely using your network to get any position is important.
Okay, great, thanks. There's one question, but it's five upvotes, and this is gonna be for you, Madeline, which is, how do you get in the door kind of at liberal arts colleges? And I think specifically what they're asking is, how do those schools weight teaching experience versus research experience? And how do you think about that now that you're kind of in that position?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and kind of important to be thinking about while you're still, in grad school or doing a postdoc. And my advisor at UChicago was kind of pretty clear about how to do this too. She had had previous students go this route. And one of the most important things was to get a visiting position. It was pretty clear, and being on the hiring side now, like, it's pretty clear that when an institution wants to hire somebody to be a professor at a liberal arts college where you are doing teaching and research, and yes, both are expected, they want to have somebody who's good with students, and you don't have time to kind of let your first year go by and not be so good at it. You really need to be there right away. And so a visiting position, which has no tenure implications, was a fantastic kind of experience for that. It was really hard doing six new preps, but it taught me a lot. I was able to try a lot of things out without worrying about the implications for tenure. So I think that was really important. And also the TA experience that I got at UChicago and kind of jumping at opportunities to guest lecture in classes too, and giving as many talks as possible. And you know, getting really comfortable talking in front of students, and not lecturing at them, but like talking with them. And I think that was the most important part. In my field, it, you know, postdocs just aren't as common. It was harder to find something that was of interest, and I already had three really big research projects going, and really didn't see how it was going to be possible to add another one and still finish anything. And so I didn't go the research postdoc route. The department I'm in right now, we have six faculty. No one did a postdoc. Everyone went straight from a PhD at an R1. So everyone was coming from kind of high-powered programs and did not do a research postdoc. But I do have friends who have gotten liberal arts positions and they did do postdocs. But, you know, it's great to have the extra research experience, but it's really your skills at working with students that end up mattering the most for those kinds of jobs. Yeah. And I will add also, and I think this relates to one of the other questions about like giving your job talks. And I tailored them to every place I went. And so I do geology and paleontology. And so I did a little research into the geology and fossils of that particular area that each college was located in, or university, and I added slides about that into my talk. I found ways to connect my research to their location and to what people there were already interested in, and I did that in both my research talks and in my teaching talks, so I think that was really important, and people remembered that, actually, so I would recommend doing that.
Yeah, that's in one, and you can feel free to disagree with me, and this may also be a difference between fields, but one a chemistry professor at Haverford that I was talking to, and I asked her the same thing, is a research postdoc advisable? One of my students wants to go to a PUI, and she had asked the same thing. And this person at Haverford said that when they hire you at a PUI, they are good at teaching, so they can teach you how to be a really good teacher, but they can't provide the resources for a really top-notch research program as much as like an R1 school can. So they really, she said that she thought a research postdoc was a really good idea, just because it gives you the chance to really show with very clearly that you can do excellent research, that track record is rock solid. I thought that was interesting when I heard that, but that's maybe a little bit of a different flavor on what you're saying. And again, that may be field dependent. Chemistry may be quite a bit different than geology in that case, where postdocs are very common for many people. So.
And I think it also kind of depends on who the other applicants are that year for that particular job. Like, you know, you're never going to know really who you're up against. And so, you know, prepare yourself for what kind of future you want. And so like, if you feel like you really need these extra skills to, you know, make your lab work, like by all means, go do it. But you know, just kind of be confident in like what track you wanna have, because the more confident you are in that, the more you're gonna stand out against other applicants.
Okay, the next question was the most, Saf, did you wanna say something?
Yeah. I want to just add a couple of words, saying that having no teaching experience obviously is a not really good idea for academia, because it's not about you being considered like as a bad applicant or something. Sometimes, like in physics, for the most part, people are hired because of the research that they are doing. So, and in the first place, everybody's interested in the research and what kind of a lab you're going to build. So, and which is again connected with what kind of a grants you're going to apply for and what kind of a money you're going to bring to the university. So teaching is probably less of a focus, but if you don't have any teaching experience, it might be really challenging for you to start teaching right away, or even start teaching it like after half a year, for example. So it depends on like your, how you negotiated your startup and what are the terms, but having zero teaching experience is kind of challenging because you might have problems. So it's a really good idea to have a teaching experience, at least some. TA, I would recommend doing TA for at least a year, like at least a year. But if you have opportunities like teaching some kind of a small classes, like doing journal club, anything like that, that counts. And it really helps you when you actually would start teaching your own classes. So consider this seriously. So it's not like it's a game changer on your CV, but this is a really helpful skill to you in the first place. So yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
No, that makes sense. And I guess my comment wasn't to say that teaching is not important. I think my impression is that PUIs is that many of the applicants will have a very strong teaching background. So there, a difference maker might be having a really good postdoc. So I think there's different flavors of it, but multiple pieces of it may matter to some extent. So, okay, well, the next question with the most upvotes at any rate was, which is a good one, is what was most surprising to you about the job, department, or institution during your first year in the position? So what was the single most important thing? So actually, or most surprising thing. So actually, Beatrice, why don't we start with you, if you don't mind, since you haven't had a chance to talk in a little bit. What have you found most surprising during your first 6 months, I guess?
Going from a private to public university, that was a humongous change. So I did my postdoc at Northwestern, right? And then my PhD at Northwestern, and then my postdoc at UChicago. So the leverage that you have there, you don't have it in a public institution. For better or for worse, public institution has to be far more transparent than private. So everything is far more controlled. So just for instance, like to do a conference right now, a little symposium, although it was canceled because of the situation, I have to go through so many layers to get anything approved. Even to get the food, I couldn't select who was the person that they want to buy the food from. When in UChicago, I could go buy something and that's it, right? So that was one of the biggest changes for me, like going from having like this, whatever I want to do type of thing with the money to go through so many layers. And also the resources. In a public institution, normally you don't have as many resources as in the private institution. So that was a big challenge. On the other hand, I love the diversity that you have in a public institution that you don't get so much in the private. So UIC, for instance, is like, in terms of undergrads, is just amazing. Like, they are like all kind of races, ethnicities, like background, anything. And also it's like a commuter, kind of commuting school. So you get all kind of people. I think that for me has been very enriching, that part. That I haven't seen it that much into the Northwestern at UChicago. I think that there are pros and cons for everything. But yeah, that was like the two most surprising things for me.
Yeah. Anyone else? What has shocked people?
Huh?
Anybody has been shocked by anything?
No, how could you be shocked? If you're shocked, then you don't know what you're doing. Like you went there, you saw people, right? So you're more or less like you read about the institute. So you kind of like when you were coming to the site interview, you already knew much about the place, right? When you accepted the offer, you knew probably like twice as much as you knew and something on top of that. So you've done a research, like a solid research. So then you accepted, and then like what kind of surprise you may have? But pleasant surprises, yes. Unpleasant surprises. Well, that means that you haven't done your research right.
I can say for me, one thing that I found, I kind of knew, and someone had told me this before I started, but I still found a little surprising was to some extent the isolation that you have as a PI. So when you're as a grad student or even a postdoc, you're in a group, in chemistry at least, you're in a group of 5, maybe 10 people. They're your peers. You can go get coffee with them. You can talk about projects with a lot of detail, right? And particularly in your first year or two, when you're building up a group and you don't have that many students, you have colleagues, but it's very different, right? They're interested in different problems than what you're interested in, different science in many cases. So that was something that wasn't, I don't know if surprise was the right word. So, like I said, someone had warned me about that, but that was something that was a big adjustment, was switching into the PI role where you don't have a group of comrades you can go grab lunch with and say, hey, how'd this reaction work? Or what, oh, look at that data set. What is that? You know, and that I think is a tough thing that I thought in the first year for me personally.
I would agree with that, John. Being at a small institution too, like there's, you know, even fewer people kind of talking on the same page. But the positives that have come from this have been, well, I mean, one, you know, I knew that this was going to happen. And it was more dramatic in my visiting position than it is in my tenure track position. So one thing I've done is that I have, you know, not shied away from reaching out to kind of colleagues and friends at other institutions who, you know, I can bounce ideas around with. And so I was sometimes hesitant to do that as a grad student. And now I, you know, just am excited to get to talk to people about my science. And then the other thing is that I have really enjoyed this opportunity getting to talk with my current colleagues who, you know, they're all geologists of some sort, but like I have learned so many new things. And I think that's been really fun and things that I didn't realize I was interested in. And it's got me kind of thinking about my own work in new ways. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd echo that. Reach out, keep that network with other institutions going. And yeah, if you have something that you're excited about, even if you have someone that's pretty far afield in your department, get them a coffee and make them excited. You know, that's a good way to get to know your colleagues in the picture science too. So, okay. Any other surprises that anyone wants to share? Okay, if not, let's move on. We don't have too much time left, maybe 10 minutes. So the next one, at least with 2 upvotes, is startup. So Madeline already offered kind of an interesting take, which is, all right, I'm burn, baby, burn. I'm going to get my lab set up and get everything going in the first year. And I think that's a message that I've heard as well, which is spend as much, you need to spend money to make money, which is I want to get my lab up as soon as possible, and I'm going to spend that money. Avery had a slightly different take, which I also appreciate, which is that money is gold, right? If you don't spend it, you can spend it on anything for the rest of your time at the institution, right? So if you have the chance to save some of that money, then that's great, right? That's really valuable funds that you can use for anything. So Stas and Beatrice, any thoughts on strategies for spending startup?
I mean, I am getting everything I can. So I, my lab are not that big. I don't need as a big wet lab as most, some of you will need, but I still need to buy some stuff. And also the thing that I find very important is you need people. So I have not been limiting myself in any of those 2 cases. I have already submitted my R-trans. I have already submitted an R21. I am submitting an R01 in June, just because I was very lucky of getting in my postdoc all the preliminary data. I am getting a few publications, so I hope that I will get it in a year or two, something, so that will allow me. But I think that, yeah, unless that you don't think that you're gonna get funded in like 2-3 years from now, I think that just try to be try to make use of that money and get as many things as possible so you can start getting data, publications and everything. And also it's important use that money to go to meetings where other people can see you, where you can meet the people that they are gonna review your grants, right? So you really wanna, I mean, I think that you need to be picky, don't go everywhere, but go to a specific places that people can appreciate your job and say good things about you. I have some friends that they haven't spent it until they have been like very like not spending at all, and then they have regretted because they have not been using it.
Can I say,
yeah.
I think one of the things that I've heard that saving your startup for is new equipment that later years after you've had your lab, you're an associate professor, it's difficult to buy new equipment, especially new specialized new equipment that's coming into the field that wasn't there when you started. And so it's difficult to get funds for that. So it's nice to hold on to some non-discretionary funds in order to get do things like that, but also to continue to travel and go to conferences years after you started. I will say that we've had recently a concern amongst the junior investigators who still have their startups because of the current economic situation that your startup money is promissory. It is money that is promised to you over a certain period of time, but it's not guaranteed at any one moment. The university doesn't have that much cash on hand to pay everyone their startups immediately. And so that's why you have to request special permission from the provost in order to use your startup funds all at one time. And so when there isn't enough cash on hand, the university needs to, for instance, buy as much PPE as they can. They need to use their cash on hand, and so you don't have access to your startup. So we've actually been asked not to spend our startup funds right now, to hold that and use any government money or foundational grants that you have. And hold startups because that cash may not be available.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I would add to what everyone was saying about the startup. So it depends. So if it's indeed unlimited, so it's like you can hold, like live it and like, yeah. So the first thing, yes, indeed, that's a very great point. So the new equipment, so it's really hard to buy equipment like on a grant, like especially like if you want to upgrade something in your lab. And the second thing is like, if you really need to spend, if you really need something, right, in your lab, then don't hesitate, just like, you know, spend as much as you need. But if you like, don't know like whether you really need it or not, then probably it's a good idea just to hold on, right, and leave this money for later. The second thing is what I've learned there are, so, but this is mostly about funding students, right? So you may use your startup just right away to hire a lot of students and just pay them from your startup. That's one option. The other option, there are a lot of programs and grants and other things you can apply for, or university have different programs. So if you can figure out about those programs, you can basically hire the students and not pay them money from your startup. That would be a great thing, like from two perspectives. The first perspective, you will actually get to know your students, who they are, like, and they will get to know you if they like it or not. So they will have you this, like, you'll have this nice period of like everybody figuring out whether they like really want to work at your lab or not. And you're not investing your startup money into this, you know? So you kind of like saving a bit, and that gives you like this grace period if you want so. So it's always a good idea to seek for different opportunities and not to invest your whole startup right away if you have this option. Or if you like, if you don't need to buy the whole lab or specific equipment. So you should not leave the money for later if you really need them. So you have to spend them as much as you need. But if you have other options, well, it's probably a good idea for the unlimited startup to try to fund what you want, especially, for example, students from other sources. I would tell you some.
Yeah, and I'll echo that. I think I'm horrifically cheap, so my postdoc advisor knew that, and he told me, John, you need to spend your money. So I wanted to hold on to all of it and just let it dribble out. And he said, you're insane. If you need an instrument, you need to get that instrument and start doing experiments right away, right? But I think, the other thing that you'll hear echoed is that treat it like the gold that it is, which is, be really careful with your expenditures, see if there's any workaround, the program that can fund that student, can you get the department to buy that instrument for you, these sorts of things, right? So don't be afraid to try to leverage other resources to get what you need. Okay, we're almost out of time. The last question that Al has four thumbs up, which is a hard one to answer, and I think we all know what the answer is, but you may not want to hear it, which is, do you think faculty openings will be limited in the next couple of years due to the economic decline?
John, can I say that one's also related to the last question as well?
Okay, I didn't see that down there. How has coronavirus affected your research lab and affect tenure plans? Yeah, that's right. Thanks for pointing that out. So does anyone want to start?
Yes, I can say, because we've been having these meetings multiple times a week now. There's at my institution, there's currently a hiring freeze. And so we have faculty recruitment happening, but we have to tell those people that we can't hire them now. We aren't sure when we will be able to hire them. We're continuing to interview people, but letting them know that as of right now, no one is going to be hired until we know better about our funding. And how does that affect tenure clock? Every single individual who's on the tenure track has been told that they can apply for a one-year extension on their tenure clock. I think most people will do that. You don't have to necessarily take that 1 year, but it's there for us. And has that affected our research? Definitely, it has shut our lab down, but my lab has actually been very focused on SARS-CoV-2 and how we can switch what we do, which is use T cells to target post-translational modifications on tumors to look at post-translational modifications on the virus, and how do we use the reagents that we have to neutralize viral infections. So yes, it's affected us, but it may open up new doors for research for us.
So slightly different Avery's institution. The college, Albion College, has continued hiring everyone that we had kind of committed searches to this year. That didn't change, but any new position requests for hiring next year that were being reviewed, those have all been frozen. So I think that there's probably going to be a slump next year. I don't have access to my building or lab anymore. I'm now writing instead of doing microscope work. I guess the other thing similar to Avery, We don't have to apply for it. We can just designate if we want a 1 or 2 semester delay on the tenure clock. And then we also have the ability to not include our course evaluations from this term in our tenure package because switching to online is a little unexpected, and we did it in a weekend. And so there wasn't really preparation time. And I guess the other thing that impacts geology is that I had a couple class field trips that got canceled, and then a field course that I was supposed to teach this summer, those were canceled. And so that's kind of interfered with my salary in some way, because that was additional salary to teach field course. And so that kind of has been taken away. Yeah.
I mean, in my case, all my research is stopped because it's human. So we have to stop collection of any type of human data. I'm not allowed to even contact my patient. So that part is stopped, but the beauty of what I do is systems biology, right? So I don't need to generate more data. There are tons of data outside there. So I would say whoever can go and mine data out there, trying to come up with another way to analyze your data and so on. So for us, that has been a big thing. We are moving everything just to computational work as so as right now. But yeah, you need to be creative. I don't think that there will be so much funding for doing like even basic research. I don't think so. You need to get creative and go more into translational things that would help right now. I don't think that there will be money for professor. I don't know if professor we are gonna have money for postdocs. So it may be like we all need to get ready for the right. So I'm sorry, I don't have good news.
Yeah, I'll just as a data point, yes, I think there will be less job openings. In Chicago, they haven't announced anything particular, and we're probably in a better position than many to weather this. But I wouldn't be surprised if the way that we have set it up, they don't make full announcements. They just say no on a case-by-case basis. And I think that it totally has trashed my research program right now. It's incredibly frustrating because we're very lab intensive, we're very experimental, so all of my students can't do anything. And it's very frustrating that, a doggy daycare is considered essential and our labs are shut down. That's a real kick in the teeth every time. and then, everyone in Chicago PSD has been offered, they can apply for a year tenure extension. So I think that's standard at most schools.
I'm thinking like what happened in 2008, it was the other way around. The administration started pouring money in research to try to come up, to try to help and try to come up with new ideas, new startups. I don't know how the administration this time is going to be, but I hope that it's that way for our own sake, that they try to invest money and come up with another way. But
interest rates are low, so maybe they'll buy up. We'll see.
I think for senior postdocs, this is important also because there won't be a lot of jobs on the market. I know my institution has extended postdocs were capped at 5 years. Now they've given a 1 year extension, so postdocs can remain for 6 years now to help you look for jobs, and hopefully there will be more jobs opening in the next year once we figure out what each institution's economic situation looks like.
In physics, I'll just make a remark on coronavirus thing. We switched to theory, we can afford this, but we just switched to theory. So, it's not like it really affected. Well, to me, it basically like it ruined two experiments that were planned because labs are shut down right now. But okay, the good thing that we're not doing the experiments, we just switched to doing theory, and we can afford this. So. See the good thing of doing physics.
Yeah, we're trying to do theory. It's not going well.
No, don't say that.
It's not going well. All right. Well, we are technically out of time. Brianna, you can chime in. There's a few other questions, but I think at least one of them, let me check this one off because we kind of talked about that. And there's a few, I guess we talked about coronavirus and faculty opening. So do you think we should wrap it here, or what's the consensus?
Yeah, no, I think we should wrap up here. I really appreciate all of your time and going through so many of the Q&A, the questions that were submitted. I just wanted to let everyone know that I put something just now into the chat box to really encourage both the alumni that are on this panel, but also our attendees in the audience to use WISER. It's the University of Chicago's networking platform. It's relatively new, but what's nice is that it can facilitate further conversations right through the platform itself. So thank you all so much for your time. Thank you for being part of GradUCon 2020. We made it happen online, and I can't appreciate just all of you continuing to be committed to sharing your expertise and your advice to all of these grad students and postdocs. So that's all I have, and just wanted to say thank you again.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
All right. Stay safe and healthy and sane.
Yes, safe and healthy and sane. That's right.
All right, bye.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Right. Bye. Bye-bye.